Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Okay, so you mentioned anorexia, and, you know, we probably spent about 10 minutes or so before I started the interview just kind of getting some basic history from you, and I've got quite the list here of diagnoses that you've been given throughout your life. So can I just kind of go down that list, and then we can kind of just get a little bit of your history on some of these, and whether or not you feel like you truly had all of these, or if they were just given to you because of all the complications, and, you know, whether maybe some mistakes were made. But I have down dissociative disorder. I have down depression with obviously extreme to the point of suicidal ideations. And also you were cutting and burning yourself. I've got dysthymia, which is a lower case of depression, which is more chronic depression, but maybe not as severe. We've got bipolar, which is also another form of depression that includes manic episodes. We've got borderline personality disorder and passive-aggressive personality disorder, which is no longer in the DSM-4, but I remember it was in the DSM-3. We've got a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. We've got anorexia. We've got OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, which falls under the anxiety camps. We've got generalized anxiety disorder. And then currently you've got, again, under the depression family, something called severe refractory depression. So am I covering it all there?
Yeah, pretty much. As much as I remember. And it's plenty if I don't remember the rest, so that's okay.
Okay. So going back to your telling me that your first suicidal attempt was when you were 16 years of age, can we go back and just maybe slightly discuss what kind of family you grew up in, and why were you depressed? Was this genetic, biological depression? Was there trauma? Because I'm assuming if you were diagnosed with PTSD, there's been some trauma in your life. Was that childhood trauma? Why don't we go back to just maybe some of the environmental factors that were affecting either your childhood or adolescence to start some of these things?
Interesting. The first child was a boy, and then there were like five girls. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. I can't remember. And I knew my dad wanted a boy, and I was not. I was a girl, and I had felt kind of in my heart all of my life that he resented that I wasn't a boy because he had wanted one, and he was. In Massachusetts, we lived in Oregon at the time. He was in Massachusetts when I was born. My mom called and told him that I was born. It was something that was just kind of in my head, in my body. Somehow I just knew. It was never confirmed until my dad passed away and my sister was going through trying to sort out letters and pictures and stuff to whose they were and who they belonged to and everything. And she sent me a letter that my mom had sent to my dad. And she had actually said, now, it's a girl, and this is what we're naming her. And she's so beautiful. I hope you'll come to love her. She's got dark hair and dark eyes. And I hope you won't. I hope you'll be able to get over your disappointment that she's not a boy. And when I read that, it was like, I knew. And so somewhere that was a piece of, but there was also my dad was physically abusive, as a lot of, I'm not the only one, you know, you talk to people in my age group and their dads did that. They were raised doing that.
Being done to them, you mean? Yes.
Yes. You know, you pull out a belt or the strap that you used for shaving or whatever, and, you know, you would beat the kids. So the thing that made it particularly damaging with my dad was that he, and this is why I'm sure biologically the depression in him, I remember he was so unpredictable. I remember we knew what time he came home from work, and I remember hiding out in my room until I knew which way the wind was blowing and who was in trouble. And if it wasn't me, then I could come out of my room. But if it was me, then I stayed in there as long as possible, because if I came out, then I was going to get it. And that was my survival technique. I remember being so angry at him when he would beat me. And, you know, my mom would always try to pull him off of us. It was very hard for her. But he would, I was a mean one. I was like, you can hit me all you want. You are not going to see me cry. And I think now that I look back, I had one brother that was the same way. And my mother has since said, for more reasons than this, that I was the hardest out of 10 to raise, and this other brother was the second hardest. And I think that kind of spurred him on, the fact that I didn't cry, and so that he would maybe extend the beating for longer. And as soon as he would go leave the room, I remember I would go to the bottom of my closet and pile clothes over me, and I would just in my mind scream, why can't you just talk to me? Why can't you just talk to me? I can answer you. I don't understand why you have to do this. Why can't I can understand things. I'm not stupid. Talk to me. And being so bitterly angry, and I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, just so there was that, along with the uncertainty. There was, and we weren't allowed to cry. He didn't want a lot of crying. And he didn't want to hear our feelings. You weren't allowed to express feelings, even if you had them. It was very oppressive. It was very oppressive. And then for me, there were some other factors, and this is really hard for me. This is really hard for me because I was in denial for a long time, even though, again, it's one of those things I knew in my body that it was right. I was sexually abused at 3, and it went until I was about 12, not with the same person. One of the people was a family member, and I shoved it, and I was threatened not to tell, or I would be hurt further, or they would hurt someone in my family. Or, well, when you're 3 years old, you don't even know how to frame something like that. You're not even really sure what happened. You just know that you've been told that if you say anything, someone's going to be hurt. And so there were those other factors, and I won't go into that a lot more. Just to say it created, and there were environmental things also accompanying the genetic predisposition to the depression. So my house was, I have to give my dad credit. He always took us on vacations, made sure that we did that. He would take us fishing. He'd come home early on a Saturday. We'd go up to the mountains. But I learned at a really young age that it felt dangerous to be around him. And so I tried to get out of the outings. And sometimes I was successful and sometimes not. But they weren't particularly happy, la, 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 family outings, you know. Right. I think he meant well. I think he wanted to try I don't think anyone, no one's all good, no one's all bad. I'm not sure he even knew what was going on with him, because, you know, that many years ago, people didn't talk about it. It's not as open as it is now. I don't know that he understood it all. I know that by the brother just younger than me, there were three kids after that, and I know that a lot of the physical abuse stopped at that point. But because we weren't allowed to express freely, express emotions, cry, when I did start therapy, the doctors would say, well, what are you feeling? I had no words. I didn't know. To this day, I still struggle. If something happens to me, I go to someone and I talk to them and I think this is what I'm feeling and I say it. And then as I talk more or they ask me more questions, I realize, no, that's not what I'm feeling. It's this. It takes me a long time to put a real name to what's going on inside me, because I shut those down so effectively at 3 years old. And I remember one of my psychiatrists said to me, I've noticed that you cry three tears and then you stop. Hmm. And I said, oh, three? I usually don't let it get to three. It's usually two.
Wow.
And that would be it. And sometimes I would say, you know, I just wish I could cry. I just wish I could cry for like an hour and just get some of this out of my body. And he'd say, I wish you could too. Go for it. Just let go. And I can't to this day. I can't. I don't cry. It's minimal, and then I go on. And I don't care. There's no label, good or bad. It's just what is. And you find ways to deal with it. So I might be sad. I don't have to cry. I can still feel sad, but I don't. There doesn't seem to be a huge need for tears. But so it's taken me, my husband used to wonder why I couldn't communicate easily with him or a lot with him. And it's just because you can't know what you don't know. You can't do what you don't know how to do. And that wasn't modeled for me. In fact, it was discouraged. And so, and quite a few of the people in my family, my brothers and sisters, have problems with the same thing, expressing emotions and talking, and some of us have finally learned that we can have a voice. I can now talk about things. I would sit in on group therapies and not say anything, and they'd get to me and, Sally, what do you have to say? And I would not talk. And it took a long, long time for me to learn that I wasn't that age anymore, and my dad wasn't there. But you start out gradual. You start out really gradual, and it took a long. It was neighbors and friends would call because I was a great listener. It was easier to listen to them than to talk about me. And so I would listen and ask questions, and what are they going to do about it, or how do you feel about this? And so I was a great listener, but I couldn't talk. And it took a long, long time to find, like I said, that I had a voice and I had things to say. And when I raised my boys, when they talked to me, I have always tried to remember to say, well, so how did that make you feel? Hmm. And what did you think about that? Or did you learn something from that, you know, that exchange? And what would have been a better solution? And I've tried to throw out things like that to let them know that they can think and feel and express and not hold it in. Jay is really good at doing that. My younger Jay is not as good at doing that. But he was 5 years younger when I was in the psych hospitals a lot. And I think of what both of them must have gone through, wondering, oh, she's gone again. How long before she comes home? 2 weeks? 7 weeks? Is she going to attempt suicide? again when she gets home. I can't even begin to imagine at their ages how they put that into a place to get up and go to school every day and be the star students that they were. We never had problems with our kids. They're awesome kids, very smart. Both of them are very smart, very intelligent. They're the kinds where you walk in and you see a chalkboard and it's got numbers all across the chalkboard and you go, oh, that's not really a problem. And they can work the problem. You know, they know what the symbols mean, and I'm going, nah, that's not really a math symbol. And they are very bright, and never worry about them. We'd set curfews if they were going to be late. They would call. They'd tell me, oh yeah, we have kids on the way home all the time ask if we want to do drugs, but we don't want to. Why would we want to do that? And so I was very, very fortunate. Very fortunate, and to have gotten the children that I did, because I fully realized life could have been much, much harder than it was had I been worrying about, you know, kids dating girls and getting them pregnant or on drugs and legitimately with all that was going on at home and the depression. If they did that, I don't think I would have blamed them. You know, to try to cope with that and handle it any way they could. I would not have held anything against them for that, but I'm awfully grateful that they didn't.
Right. So going back to your 16-year-old self, it's not so hard to imagine why you might be suicidal or why you were severely depressed. You didn't have really emotional coping skills. You were living kind of in a chronic state of anxiety and fear and tension in your home. Was this mainly just with your father? What role did your mother play in this? What was their relationship like? Like, did this violence and tension also take place in their marriage? So you saw that as well in the marriage piece? Or
I did not see it between them, but I have older sisters that say that my dad did hit my mom a few times, but I never did see it. So, but yeah, there was a lot of tension between my parents. You know, raising 10 kids is really expensive, and you know there's never a ton of money, and you know there's lots of things that can create tension. My mom was very good-hearted. I would say my mom tended to be an optimist. And so they were probably not real well suited to each other.
Did they stay together throughout their marriage? You mentioned that your father was in Massachusetts. I didn't know if that was work-related or...
Oh, it was training for the field that he wanted to go into.
Okay.
But yes, they stayed together. They were together, and my dad passed away first, and then my mother passed away, and they were married, lived together right to the end.
And were you ever able to discuss any of this with either one of your parents, or did that just not really ever come up as far as how you felt you had been treated or some of the family dynamics there?
I discussed it with my mother. Almost in a way, you know, to hurt her. Well, that sounds awful. I wanted her to know how much it hurt us, but in letting her know that, I knew it hurt too, and that she had already paid that price. But I didn't know how to let her know the damage that it had done, and without getting real intense with her telling her the impact. And so I know it hurt her. I'm not sure that it was intentional. I just knew that it would hurt her if I brought it up and talked about it. But after enough years, it was time to bring it up and talk about it. And then eventually I was able to talk to her about the sexual abuse. And we were actually, because I kept doubting it. I kept doubting it. With the psychiatrist, oh no, 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 and the one said, you know what, you have more information to back up that that happened than most people I talk to that say there was sexual abuse. And he says, why do you keep resisting that? And I said, really? Really? Wouldn't you want to keep resisting that? Mm-hmm. Who wants to own that one? Who wants to say, yeah, this happened to me? And, you know, it is an awful, terrible, horrible thing. And especially when it's someone in your family that's supposed to care about you and love you. And I couldn't get that, you know, he couldn't quite get that, but maybe he was looking at a different angle than I was. But I had talked to her about it, and she talked to my grandma about it. And my grandma absolutely supported me and what I said had happened, and that she didn't doubt for a minute that it had. I had a sister that supported it. And so,
do you know if this happened to other sisters of yours as well, since it was a family member, or?
They all say no.
Okay.
They all say no, but I have one sister that I, particularly the one time when it was the family member, she was the only one that was with me at the time, and she ran out, and I was left there, and, she says that she heard me crying, and she kept throwing rocks at the trees so that she couldn't hear me crying. And all the way home, I sat in the corner of the car and wouldn't talk to anybody. And she remembered everything, the swimming suit that I had on, and yeah, I told her I remembered it too. And so there's, she says that it did not happen to her. We have another sister and I have wondered, but you know, it took me a long time to get to where I could say, yeah, sexual abuse. And so she may or may not ever get there, and it may not matter or be important for her. So I don't know that one for sure. I just have my suspicions.
Okay.
My dad, interestingly enough, my dad, when he heard about it and who it was, wrote me a letter saying, well, do you understand that he would have been like 83 years old, 80 years old at the time this would have happened to you? And I hit the fan. I'm like, so freaking what? Do 80-year-olds not, do they lose their attraction, or, you know, so what are you calling me? You're not supporting. But he did go on to say, but I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I'm just giving you another piece of information. But I thought that was a little bit not supportive, and it made me doubt again. And mostly you hit a point, I mean, for a long, long time, I could not hear about children being abused without taking that on myself. I could not hear about, in the news, about children being sexually abused without having that hit me again and going through that, ooh. And now I still sorrow. I still sorrow that it happens. But I don't tend to take it in. Once in a while, I still will, because I know what the family will have to go through.
And how old were you when you kind of started having these thoughts of allowing yourself to see yourself as somebody who had been sexually abused?
Let's see, the breast cancer happened. I must have been in my 40s, early 40s, 41, 42 maybe, before, maybe even 43, before I finally could whisper, yes, I think I was. And then I couldn't say it very loud. And then as soon as I did, I kept denying it. So it was a yes, denial, a constant battle within me. Because, you know, who really wants to think they were? Who wants to accept that one? You know, and so denial is an easy place to go for that one, until finally, I guess I decided, you know, I may never know the truth of this anymore. Now, again, you don't get to decide what happened. You get to decide how you're going to deal with it. Are you going to let it control your life and be the impetus for what? And so eventually as I started getting a little bit stronger, I started making different decisions, different choices.
About how you would think about this, or?
About the importance of whether it was true or not, because that was what was hard for me to accept. I didn't want it to be true, and that was why I kept vacillating and going back and forth. And finally, I decided, you know, it wasn't critical whether I knew the absolute truth or not. If it's something that I believed had happened, and interestingly enough, I don't know if I said this before, when I mentioned it to my husband after I finally had said it, he said, "Sally, I've known that for years." And I said, "How did you know?" And he said, "Just in our relationship with each other, our sexual relationship with each other."
Wow.
So finally, I just decided not to give a lot of things a lot more power, and just say, "Well, okay, here it is, and if I get to wherever I get and see whatever truth is there and it's different, then I'll shift from there. I have no problems making that shift. But if it was what, if it is what it is, then I've also decided to move on and not let it overtake me anymore." It is a long process.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
A lot of pain.
Right. And do you think that, because I think what I am hearing is that you would say at this point, you would couch yourself as a survivor of sexual abuse. So you would say that did happen to you, correct?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So
yes.
Can you walk me through a little bit? Because I find this a lot with the people I work with in these similar situations, as far as the kind of what you spoke to earlier, as far as the If I even think that this happened to me, you know, what does that mean? Not wanting to accept that. Can you talk a little bit more about why you feel that, you know, you talk about, yeah, who would want to think that? And I totally get that. Can you extrapolate on that more? Can you give me more about that? Is that shame? Is it about blaming yourself? Is it about what that means as far as how you define yourself as a person?
Oh, yeah. Whoa. Well, the biggest thing became, once I understood that, once I got that it happened more than once, and over a period of years, it was like, oh my gosh, what did I walk away with? A stamp on my forehead that said, "Here I am, easy mark, get me," you know. But it was, okay, so what did I do? Why did this keep happening? Why did it repeat itself with me? And I'd have them say to me, "Well, predators are really good. They watch how a person walks. If they stand up straight, they tend to be able to spot victims and people that act and walk like victims." They'd explain all of those things. Well, great. Knowing that didn't really help a lot.
There's still a sense of maybe blame there, in the sense of why was I acting like a victim?
Right. And what was I doing? What was I putting out there that kept bringing this to me? It must be something I'm doing, because it didn't look like it happened to anyone else in my family or anyone I knew. And so there was that part that was really hard. Then there was the part of, why didn't I tell somebody? Why didn't I go tell my dad? Why didn't I go tell my mom? Why didn't I tell a brother or sister, hey, this happened? And the only thing I can go back to is, you're terrified. You don't know if they're really going to carry it out or not. And they've threatened people, me or parents, and you don't you don't want to bring out, I don't want to bring out, I didn't want to be responsible for anybody else hurting. And so you just shut your mouth and do what they tell you to do. And yet, as I look at myself, and I tend to be a fighter, and I think a survivor, that goes so against what I am. But then I have to remember, I probably wasn't a fighter and a survivor at 3 and 5 and all of those years. I have learned to grow into that. One of the big things that I learned through therapy was victim, and how much I, and I would have doctors say, you know, I was just a victim, acting like a victim. And I remember just being mad as heck at him and saying, well, you think? Because guess what? I was a victim. I was. I'm a, you know, right. What do you want me to do? And, but then I started, when I finally accepted that there was a certain way that I was acting as a victim that I didn't like, and that it wasn't serving me to continue acting like a victim, that then that helped turn things around. And yes, sometimes still things happen and I drop into victimhood, but I recognize it really fast now, and I try to go, oh, okay, you were being a victim again, let's move that to that other place, because you know that does not serve you to be in that place. And but yeah,
can you talk a little bit about what some of those red flags are for you? Like, how do you recognize that?
Like somebody might say something, and it's really kind of a benign statement, or it should have been a benign statement, not real hurtful, but I would tend to take it personal, that it was aimed at me, and it hit kind of at a core piece of me or a core belief of myself. And so I immediately drop into that insignificant person who has no confidence, whose self-esteem is in the toilet, who isn't worth anything, who doesn't have anything to offer the world, who is less than. I drop into less than.
So it's almost like this self-critique voice in your mind that yes, you start listening to.
Yes. And then I drop into blaming. I want that person to be at fault, and that person to be at fault, and that person to be at fault. And then I go, whoa. And then eventually I'll go, whoa, wait a minute. I get it. I'm doing victim again. Stop. Go back. Let's look at this and where we're at and decide how we're going to make the shift for it to be different. And that's an ongoing process, and it isn't easy. And depending on what it is, sometimes it takes longer. And sometimes I can shift right out of it and be okay. It depends on what other factors are going on, I guess, in my life at the time, how resilient I feel at the time, how willing I feel to be able to fight through and say no, and to acknowledge, no, I don't have to be a victim. That's a choice I make to be treated like that or to feel like that. And if that's a choice I make, then I can choose it another way. So it's those kinds of things that happen when statements are made that I don't always understand, or I'm treated a certain way. If I'm yelled at when I think it's undeserving, just different things like that. Okay. Did that answer the whole question?
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think I just want to kind of just point out a few things that you said. I think it's very important to address this shift from going from victim status to survivor status, which I think is very commonly used language in the therapy world. And I think one thing that you said that's very important is this idea of just because we do want you to move from victim status to survivor status doesn't mean that you need to be ashamed or blaming yourself for the fact that you are in victim status. In other words, very much like what you said, you were a victim. Mm-hmm. And there's no shame in that. So just because there's something that you're working towards doesn't mean you have to feel awful about yourself because you're a victim. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I think I wanted to say about it was, you know, when you talk about yourself at three and you said, you know, I've become strong and powerful and, you know, more able maybe as an adult, and I didn't have those traits as a child. I guess I would only counter that in the sense that I think for a three-year-old to stay quiet when their parents are being threatened, or a four-year-old or even a 10-year-old, actually is a powerful thing to do. I think that that child is surviving. And I think that is a powerful thing to know how to do, is to survive something. And, you know, now when we look at it with through our own adult lens, we can see, boy, I wish I could have done something a little bit different. But, you know, kind of, I guess, giving that child, and giving that child due respect for what that child was able to do.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. So, I made it through three because I did what I was told Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's a good, I think that's a helpful and hopeful way for people to look at that if it happens to them. And instead of just looking at the fear and what I didn't do, well, not doing that, yes, kept me alive to see another day, perhaps.
That's right. Kept
me from being hurt again.
That's right.
And there's another thing that, and I've said this a lot to my kids, I'm a product today of everything that's happened in my life. And so there were things, and they made me who and what I am. I'm evolving and changing, but there are some fundamental things that made me who I am and what I am today. But I don't have to feel guilty or bad, or I just have to maybe give them their due and then move on. But all of us are products today of what our upbringing was and how we interpreted it, the lens that we viewed it from. Some of us had better lenses than others.
Well, better environments.
Yes.
For sure, yeah, that have colored our lenses. Well, one of my issues right now is that I can tell I'm going to want to talk to you for like 2 days.
I thought something like that might happen.
And Justin's the talker.
There is great power in muting the microphone.
Yeah. Well, and then there's this list of issues that, you know, you've been diagnosed with, and I feel like we could spend, you know, 2 hours easily on each one of these. So I guess in the interest of time, I guess what I'd like to get to right now is walk me through kind of the history of your symptoms. And, you know, you've mentioned hospitalizations, you've mentioned going to group therapies, I'm sure you went to individual therapy. I don't know if there was family therapy, you went to psychiatrists. So what I'd like to kind of get to right now is just what were the symptoms that got you to that point where you knew you needed help? What did you physically or emotionally go through? And then I'd like to kind of maybe get to the point where we incorporate Jay and get his perspective of what it was like to live in a family where there was all this stuff going on.
Yeah. The thing that I, as I look back at it, and it didn't take too long for me to do that, I had too much going on that I couldn't deal with. My mother-in-law was dying of Lou Gehrig's disease. I was in there taking care of her. She wanted to die at home. And Lou Gehrig's is a horrible, horrible disease. You're fully sharp. and your body just cannot function. And so there was a lot involved with that. There were three of my husband had three sisters, but the one sister and I did most of the caretaking for her. That was going on. I had a neighbor who had breast cancer, and she was dying of it. She thought because I had breast cancer, I was the only one that could truly understand. I fell into that. I don't want to call it a trap. I fell into that kind of thinking easily, thinking. And she was right. I understood it in a way that most people didn't. But it didn't mean that other people couldn't understand that this was traumatic for her and help her in whatever way they could. I did not have to take that whole thing on, especially when my kids were as young as they were and I was still trying to be Stake Young Women's president. And I'm like, it finally just hit me one day. We're putting together a girls' camp on a mountain for 150 kids, and the people I care about, my mother-in-law, is dying. Wait a minute. What's wrong with this picture? She needs help, and I need to be there for her. I want to be. It was such a sad time, and yet I am so appreciative that I had that opportunity. I got to know her in a way I never would have known her had I not been able to be in there and take care of her the way that I did. And she was the most gracious, caring, she was wonderful mother-in-law. And she was my mother too. And but something had to give. I couldn't do it all. And one day I just woke up and I was like, I remember this feeling and I am in trouble and you need to get in the phone book right now and see where you can go for help. And I had heard about the University of Utah, psychiatric doctors that you could call in and maybe get, you know, a resident or in with somebody. They also had a psych hospital. It was called Wynn at the time. And so I called and they assigned me to a resident, and I worked with him for quite a while, for a period of time. And then I had a really bad attempt. And I was
a suicide attempt.
Yes. And I was taken to the hospital and it was in ICU. And he had called that morning and I had asked him, I think, how long it would take. I can't remember what I asked him, but he knew from what I was asking him that I was going to attempt. He tried to get hold of my husband, get him to come home, and he couldn't. And I literally had the day planned out. I have this much time to do this. I need to go to the store and buy food for the kids because there's going to be a lot they're dealing with, and my husband's not going to have time to shop for food. So if I hurry and do this, then I can get that done. Then I want to come back and clean the house because he's not going to have time to do that for a while, and there's going to be a lot of people coming in. And then I think at this time of the day, I can finally take the pills. And I had it all mapped out. And I took they were an older antidepressant that are particularly deadly. And that was the first of that was the start of the attempts again. That was the first one, and the first in the new series. And then I was in psych hospitals quite a long time. Bless his heart, I had one psych tech who didn't believe I should be in there. He kept telling me I was intelligent, And he didn't understand what my problem was. And he had counted up, and I had this many visits, and what's that all about? And something like 17 visits or stays or something. And yet part of him when I was anorexic too, not just deeply suicidal.
And this anorexia was something that developed again in your 30s and 40s. This is not something that was in your adolescence. Or had you had some eating disorders in adolescent and now you were having some recurring?
I think the root of it was when I was in high school, the foundation, but I didn't understand that until a lot later. I have always weighed under what I should for my height. But finally, when it hit really big and I got scary, was in my 40s. And so I had a feed tube put in, and they were cramming food in it, and they kept accusing me of dumping because I wasn't putting on weight as fast as they thought, and, you know, it went on and on and on.
And when you say there was 17 visits, that means there was like 17 hospital stays.
Yes.
In the psychiatric department.
Yes, in varying lengths of time.
What were the times about?
Well, like some of them would be 7 weeks long. Sometimes they might be 2 weeks long. I don't know. Maybe the longest was like maybe 2 months or a little over 2 months. I don't think ever any longer than that. But varying lengths of time. And I'm not sure all of the things that constituted how long I stayed, probably how well they thought I was doing or not doing. But I remember laughing at him because it's like, okay, so we're going to discharge you tomorrow and everything's going to be okay. And you're going, yeah, this is so funny. You just had me in lockdown and you're in there. I'm in line of sight and you got people checking on me and sleeping in the doorway and watching me all the time. And I'm on a camera. There's nothing in my room. But, oh, guess what? Today I'm okay to go out in the world. And that was always so humorous to me. But it's kind of the world of mental health. They can't keep you in the hospital forever. And we do want to see if you can function again sometime in life. But there are just some things that are odd about it, but they probably, you know, they need, and insurance is a huge issue. So
how long they will pay for a stay and all of those things.
Right. Mm-hmm. And,
So was this, would you say then that this was a combination of, you're saying genetics, you're saying previous history that left you with low ability of having emotional tools readily available to you, and then what really kind of maybe was the straw that broke the camel's back was you caretook yourself to unhealth, you know, you're a caretaker, so you, I just probably made that verb up, caretook yourself to kind of having a more serious bout of symptoms?
I think. And then I think having had a number of friends die from breast cancer.
So the grief added to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And grief and some guilt. And I think it's just a combination of things. Everything aligned in my universe just right.
Yeah, there's six to ten major factors. I mean, the stress of being a mother, the you know, the breast cancer, obviously, and the surviving that, and the infertility issues that I'm sure caused emotional stress earlier in your life. I mean, yeah, there's many things here that you had to deal with.
Well, yeah, and that doesn't count. Like, I had 14 surgeries in 16 years. I blew my knee skiing. Had to have that reconstructed. Well, went going to do that and stopped and did breast cancer instead. And you know, there just kept being a lot of surgeries. There was just life was insane at our house. I do not know how my children and my husband have stayed with me and made it this long, because it truly probably felt like, What planet is this we're all on? Does this really happen? And it was really bizarre. As I look back, it was probably just really bizarre to everybody. It felt bizarre to me. I can't even imagine how it was.
Yeah, I can imagine them. as your therapist, trying to put together a timeline for you would be a pretty ongoing. That would take a while. There's all the significant issues that happened to you. Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that finally, what kicked in both the cutting and the anorexia for me, because they both basically arrived at big time at the same, I mean, where I was really into it at about the same time, and it was that element of control. Okay, this is something I control. I can decide what goes in my mouth and not, and what doesn't. I know with anorexia, that is a lot of it. And so when things start to feel really out of control in my life, guess what? I can decide what goes, what I eat and what I don't. And for the cutting, I was real clear early on. The cutting was not suicide attempts. A cutting was a release of pain.
Right.
I would go in and cut, and I would watch it bleed. I would gather all the stuff I needed, have it sitting out there, and I'd look at it and I'd say, well, is this one that needs to go for stitches, or can I put on a butterfly and wrap it up and be okay? And it took me out, that process took me out of the pain, and just, I could not deal with that internal pain anymore. And it took me out of that and put me into a release and a thinking mode. And so that's what it was for me. I'm not saying for everybody. That's what it was for me.
Yeah, I think so that's actually a very good kind of, small overview of what a lot of people who cut, and it isn't suicidal, it is not suicidal behavior. Now, it seems like you did have suicidal behavior that went along with this as well, but that's not what the cutting was about. And right. You also mentioned, I think, that you burned yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. I would take a curling iron, really hot curling iron, and roll it up my abdomen. Mm. And so I'd have burn marks all up and down my abdomen, and they were easier to hide, if I did that or cut on my abdomen or on my upper legs. So that's what I would do when I was in psych hospitals, where you can't get a hold of things to cut yourself with. Ha ha. Mm. That was kind of a little joke there, mental health joke.
Right. Right. So, and I think it's... without going into, another 3-hour podcast explaining each one of these things, it's probably very difficult for people who might be listening who have not experienced some of these things to understand how things even happen. And even like you said, your psych tech who said, well, you're intelligent, Well, most of the cutters that I know are pretty intelligent. I don't think intelligence is the factor here.
I remember saying, what does intelligence have to do with depression? And so, I don't get it.
Right.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important for people to kind of have the concept that these are diseases. These are mental health diseases that affect the brain and make people act in ways that they wouldn't normally act, and that this does not have to do with willpower or having more faith or... being a good person or not be, those kinds of choices. It really is something that affects, the brain is sick.
Yeah. Or as my best friend said, you know what to do. You just pray and ask Heavenly Father to take it, and He'll take it from you. Right. And I looked at her and like, oh my kid, really? What planet are you from? Do you think that I haven't done that? Do you think that this is how I want to live forever, and I would not have done that? It was just like, or bake more cookies. And I thought, hey, if it was all about more cookies, hey, there's no way I'd be here, because I've done that for years, So it's just a little simplistic sometimes, how people. But again, if they've had no experience with it, then they don't know where to come from with it. we can't know, like I said, we can't know what we don't know.
Right.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well. All is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard. 'Tis not so. journey's through, happy day.